Look, I took this test today, this reading test. And, Dad, they said I'm reading on a fourth grade level. Fourth grade. And I'm a junior in high school. What a difference real understanding can make. All the well-meaning advice in the world won't amount to a hill of beans if we're not even addressing the real problem. And we'll never get to the problem if we're so caught up in our own autobiography, our own paradigms, that we don't take off our glasses long enough to see the world from another point of view. I'm going to flunk, Dad. I guess I figure if I'm going to flunk, I might as well quit. But I don't want to quit. You feel torn. You're in the middle of a dilemma. What do you think I should do, Dad? By seeking first to understand, this father has just turned a transactional opportunity into a transformational opportunity. Instead of interacting on a surface, get the job done level of communication, he has created a situation in which he can now have transforming impact, not only on his son but also on the relationship. By setting aside his own autobiography and really seeking to understand, he has made a tremendous deposit in the emotional burial account and has empowered his son to open, layer upon layer, and to get to the real issue. Now father and son are on the same side of the table looking at the problem, instead of on opposite sides looking across at each other. The son is opening his father's autobiography and asking for advice. Even as the father begins to counsel, however, he needs to be sensitive to his son's communication. As long as the response is logical, the father can effectively ask questions and give counsel. But the moment the response becomes emotional, he needs to go back to empathic listening. Well, I can see some things you might want to consider. Like what, Dad? Like getting some special help with your reading. Maybe they have some kind of tutoring program over at the tech school. I've already checked into that. It takes 2 nights and all day Saturday. That would take so much time. Sensing emotion in that reply, the father moves back to empathy. That's too much of a price to pay. Besides, Dad, I told the sixth graders I'd be their coach. You don't want to let them down. But I'll tell you this, Dad. If I really thought that tutoring course would help, I'd be down there every night. I'd get someone else to coach those kids. You really want the help, but you doubt if the course will make a difference. Do you think it would, Dad? The son is once more open and logical. He's opening his father's autobiography again. Now the father has another opportunity to influence and transform. There are times when transformation requires no outside counsel. Often when people are really given the chance to open up, they unravel their own problems and the solutions become clear to them in the process. At other times, they really need additional perspective and help. The key is to genuinely seek the welfare of the individual, to listen with empathy, to let the person get to the problem and the solution at his own pace and time. Layer upon layer, it's like peeling an onion until you get to the soft inner core. When people are really hurting and you really listen with a pure desire to understand, you'll be amazed how fast they will open up. They want to open up. Children desperately want to open up, even more to their parents than to their peers. And they will, if they feel their parents will love them unconditionally and will be faithful to them afterwards and not judge or ridicule them. If you really seek to understand, without hypocrisy and without guile, there will be times when you will be literally stunned with the pure knowledge and understanding that will flow to you from another human being. It isn't even always necessary to talk in order to empathize. In fact, sometimes words may just get in your way. That's one very important reason why technique alone will not work. That kind of understanding transcends technique. Isolated technique only gets in the way. I have gone through the skills of empathic listening because skill is an important part of any habit. We need to have the skills. But let me reiterate that the skills will not be effective unless they come from a sincere desire to understand. People resent any attempt to manipulate them. In fact, if you're dealing with people you're close to, it's helpful to tell them what you're doing. I read this book about listening and empathy and I thought about my relationship with you. I realized I haven't listened to you like I should. But I want to. It's hard for me. I may blow it at times, but I'm going to work at it. I really care about you and I want to understand. I hope you'll help me. Affirming your motive is a huge deposit. But if you're not sincere, I wouldn't even try it. It may create an openness and a vulnerability that will later turn to your harm when a person discovers that you really didn't care, you really didn't want to listen, and he's left open, exposed, and hurt. The technique, the tip of the iceberg, has to come out of the massive base of character underneath. Now there are people who protest that empathic listening takes too much time. It may take a little more time initially, but it saves so much time downstream. The most efficient thing you can do if you're a doctor and want to prescribe a wise treatment is to make an accurate diagnosis. You can't say, "I'm in too much of a hurry. I don't have time to make a diagnosis. Just take this treatment." I remember riding one time in a room on the north shore of Oahu, Hawaii. There was a soft breeze blowing, and so I had opened two windows, one at the front and one at the side, to keep the room cool. I had a number of papers laid out, chapter by chapter, on a large table. Suddenly, the breeze started picking up and blowing my papers about. I remember the frantic sense of loss I felt because things were no longer in order, including unnumbered pages, and I began rushing around the room trying desperately to put them back. Finally, I realized it would be better to take 10 seconds and close one of the windows. Empathic listening takes time, but it doesn't take anywhere near as much time as it takes to back up and correct misunderstandings when you're already miles down the road, to redo, to live with unexpressed and unsolved problems, to deal with the results of not giving people psychological air. A discerning empathic listener can read what's happening down deep fast, and can show such acceptance, such understanding, that other people feel safe to open up layer after layer until they get to that soft inner core where the problem really lies. People want to be understood. And whatever investment of time it takes to do that will bring much greater returns of time as you work from an accurate understanding of the problems and issues and from the high emotional bank account that results when a person feels deeply understood. Understanding and perception. As you learn to listen deeply to other people, you will discover tremendous differences in perception. You will also begin to appreciate the impact that these differences can have as people try to work together in interdependent situations. You see the young woman, I see the old lady, and both of us can be right. You may look at the world through spouse-centered glasses, I see it through the money-centered lens of economic concern. You may be scripted in the abundance mentality, I may be scripted in the scarcity mentality. You may approach problems from a highly visual, intuitive, holistic right brain paradigm. I may be very left brain, very sequential, analytical, and verbal in my approach. Our perceptions can be vastly different. And yet we both have lived with our paradigms for years, thinking they are facts, and questioning the character or the mental competence of anyone who can't see the facts. Now, with all our differences, we're trying to work together in a marriage, in a job, in a community service project to manage resources and accomplish results. So how do we do it? How do we transcend the limits of our individual perceptions so that we can deeply communicate, so that we can cooperatively deal with the issues and come up with win-slash-win solutions? The answer is Habit 5. It's the first step in the process of win-slash-win. Even if, and especially when, the other person is not coming from that paradigm, seek first to understand. This principle worked powerfully for one executive who shared with me the following experience. I was working with a small company that was in the process of negotiating a contract with a large national banking institution. This institution flew in their lawyers from San Francisco, their negotiator from Ohio, and presidents of two of their large banks to create an 8-person negotiating team. The company I worked with had decided to go for win-slash-win or no deal. They wanted to significantly increase the level of service and the cost, but they had been almost overwhelmed with the demands of this large financial institution. The president of our company sat across the negotiating table and told them, "We would like for you to write the contract the way you want it so that we can make sure we understand your needs and your concerns. We will respond to those needs and concerns. Then we can talk about pricing." The members of the negotiating team were overwhelmed. They were astounded that they were going to have the opportunity to write the contract. They took 3 days to come up with the deal. When they presented it, the president said, "Now let's make sure we understand what you want." And he went down the contract, rephrasing the content, reflecting the feeling, until he was sure and they were sure he understood what was important to them. "Yes. That's right. No, that's not exactly what we meant here. Yes, you've got it now." When he thoroughly understood their perspective, he proceeded to explain some concerns from his perspective, and they listened. They were ready to listen. They weren't fighting for air. What had started out as a very formal, low trust, almost hostile atmosphere had turned into a fertile environment for synergy. At the conclusion of the discussions, the members of the negotiating team basically said, "We want to work with you. We want to do this deal. Just let us know what the price is and we'll sign. Then seek to be understood. Seek first to understand, then to be understood." Knowing how to be understood is the other half of Habit 5, and is equally critical in reaching win-slash-win solutions. Earlier we defined maturity as the balance between courage and consideration. Seeking to understand requires consideration. Seeking to be understood takes courage. Win/win requires a high degree of both. So it becomes important in interdependent situations for us to be understood. The early Greeks had a magnificent philosophy which is embodied in three sequentially arranged words, ethos, pathos, and logos. I suggest these three words contain the essence of seeking first to understand and making effective presentations. Ethos is your personal credibility, the faith people have in your integrity and competency. It's the trust that you inspire, your emotional bank account. Pathos is the empathic side, it's the feeling. It means that you are in alignment with the emotional thrust of another person's communication. Logos is the logic, the reasoning part of the presentation. Notice the sequence: ethos, pathos, logos, your character, and your relationships, and then the logic of your presentation. This represents another major paradigm shift. Most people, in making presentations, go straight to the logos, the left brain logic, of their ideas. They try to convince other people of the validity of that logic without first taking ethos and pathos into consideration. I had an acquaintance who was very frustrated because his boss was locked into what he felt was an unproductive leadership style. "Why doesn't he do anything?" he asked me. "I've talked to him about it, he's aware of it, but he does nothing." "Well, why don't you make an effective presentation?" I asked. "I did," was the reply. "How do you define effective? Who do they send back to school when the salesman doesn't sell the buyer? Effective means it works, it means P/PC. Did you create the change you wanted? Did you build the relationship in the process? What were the results of your presentation?" I told you, he didn't do anything. He wouldn't listen. Then make an effective presentation. You've got to empathize with his head. You've got to get into his frame of mind. You've got to make your point simply and visually and describe the alternative he is in favor of better than he can himself. That will take some homework. Are you willing to do that?" "Why do I have to go through all that?" he asked. In other words, you want him to change his whole leadership style and you're not willing to change your method of presentation? "I guess so," he replied. "Well, then," I said, "just smile about it and learn to live with it." "I can't live with it," he said. "It compromises my integrity." "Okay, then get to work on an effective presentation. That's in your circle of influence." In the end, he wouldn't do it. The investment seemed too great. Another acquaintance, a university professor, was willing to pay the price. He approached me one day and said, "Stephen, I can't get to first base in getting the funding I need for my research because my research is really not in the mainstream of this department's interests." After discussing his situation at some length, I suggested that he develop an effective presentation using ethos, pathos, and logos. "I know you're sincere and the research you want to do would bring great benefits. Describe the alternative they are in favor of better than they can themselves. Show that you understand them in depth. Then carefully explain the logic behind your request." "Well, I'll try," he said. "Do you want to practice with me?" I asked. He was willing, and so we dress rehearsed his approach. When he went in to make his presentation, he started by saying, "Now let me see if I first understand what your objectives are, and what your concerns are about this presentation and my recommendation." He took the time to do it slowly, gradually. In the middle of his presentation, demonstrating his depth of understanding and respect for their point of view, a senior professor turned to another professor, nodded, turned back to him, and said, "You've got your money." When you can present your own ideas clearly, specifically, visually, and most important, contextually in the context of a deep understanding of their paradigms and concerns, you significantly increase the credibility of your ideas. You're not wrapped up in your own thing, delivering grandiose rhetoric from a soapbox. You really understand. What you're presenting may even be different from what you had originally thought because in your effort to understand, you learned. Habit 5 lifts you to greater accuracy, greater integrity, in your presentations. And people know that. They know you're presenting the ideas with that you genuinely believe, taking all known facts and perceptions into consideration, that will benefit everyone. One-on-one. Habit 5 is powerful because it is right in the middle of your circle of influence. Many factors in interdependent situations are in your circle of concern: problems, disagreements, circumstances, other people's behavior. And if you focus your energies out there, you deplete them with little positive results. But you can always seek first to understand. That's something that's within your control. And as you do that, as you focus on your circle of influence, you really, deeply understand other people. You have accurate information to work with, you get to the heart of matters quickly, you build emotional bank accounts, and you give people the psychological air they need so you can work together effectively. It's the inside-out approach. And as you do it, watch what happens to your circle of influence. Because you really listen, you become influenceable. And being influenceable is the key to influencing others. Your circle begins to expand. You increase your ability to influence many of the things in your circle of concern. And watch what happens to you. The more deeply you understand other people, the more you will appreciate them, the more reverent you will feel about them. To touch the soul of another human being is to walk on holy ground. Habit 5 is something you can practice right now. The next time you communicate with anyone, you can put aside your own autobiography and genuinely seek to understand. Even when people don't want to open up about their problems, you can be empathic. You can sense their hearts, you can sense the hurt, and you can respond, "You seem down today." They may say nothing. That's all right. You've shown understanding and respect. Don't push, be patient, be respectful. People don't have to open up verbally before you can empathize. You can empathize all the time with their behavior. You can be discerning, sensitive, and aware, and you can live outside your autobiography when that is needed. And if you're highly proactive, you can create opportunities to do preventive work. You don't have to wait until your son or daughter has a problem with school or you have your next business negotiation to seek first to understand. Spend time with your children now, one-on-one. Listen to them, understand them. Look at your home, at school life, at the challenges and the problems they're facing, through their eyes. Build the emotional bank account. Give them air. Go out with your spouse on a regular basis. Have dinner or do something together you both enjoy. Listen to each other, seek to understand. See life through each other's eyes. My daily time with Sandra is something I wouldn't trade for anything. As well as seeking to understand each other, we often take time to actually practice empathic listening skills to help us in communicating with our children. We often share our different perceptions of the situation, and we role-play more effective approaches to difficult interpersonal family problems. I may act as if I am a son or daughter requesting a special privilege even though I haven't fulfilled a basic family responsibility, and Sandra plays herself. We interact back and forth and try to visualize the situation in a very real way so that we can train ourselves to be consistent in modeling and teaching correct principles to our children. Some of our most helpful role plays come from redoing a past difficult or stressful scene in which one of us blew it. The time you invest to deeply understand the people you love brings tremendous dividends in open communication. Many of the problems that plague families and marriages simply don't have time to fester and develop. The communication becomes so open that potential problems can be nipped in the bud. And there are great reserves of trust in the emotional bank account to handle the problems that do arise. In business, you can set up one-on-one time with your employees. Listen to them, understand them. Set up human resource accounting or stakeholder information systems in your business to get honest, accurate feedback at every level, from customers, suppliers, and employees. Make the human element as important as the financial or the technical element. You save tremendous amounts of time, energy, and money when you tap into the human resources of a business at every level. When you listen, you learn. And you also give the people who work for you and with you psychological air. You inspire loyalty that goes well beyond the 8-to-5 physical demands of the job. Seek first to understand. Before the problems come up, before you try to evaluate and prescribe, before you try to present your own ideas, seek to understand. It's a powerful habit of effective interdependence. When we really, deeply understand each other, we open the door to creative solutions and third alternatives. Our differences are no longer stumbling blocks to communication and progress. Instead, they become stepping stones to synergy. Application suggestions. 1. Select a relationship in which you sense the emotional bank account is in the red. Try to understand and write down the situation from the other person's point of view. In your next interaction, listen for understanding, comparing what you're hearing with what you wrote down. How valid were your assumptions? Did you really understand that individual's perspective? 2. Share the concept of empathy with someone close to you. Tell them or who you want to work on really listening to others and ask for feedback in a week. How did you do? How did it make that person feel? 3. The next time you have an opportunity to watch people communicate, cover your ears for a few minutes and just watch. What emotions are being communicated that may not come across in words alone? 4. Next time you catch yourself inappropriately using one of the autobiographical responses probing, evaluating, advising, or interpreting, try to turn the situation into a deposit by acknowledgement and apology. I'm sorry, I just realized I'm not really trying to understand. Could we start again? 5. Base your next presentation on empathy. Describe the other point of view as well as or better than its proponents, then seek to have your point understood from their frame of reference. Habit 6, Synergize. Principles of Creative Cooperation. I take as my guide the hope of a saint, in crucial things, unity in important things, diversity in all things, generosity. Inaugural Address of President George Bush. When Sir Winston Churchill was called to head up the war effort for Great Britain, he remarked that all his life had prepared him for this hour. In a similar sense, the exercise of all of the other habits prepares us for the habit of synergy. When properly understood, synergy is the highest activity in all life, the true test and manifestation of all of the other habits put together. The highest forms of synergy focus the four unique human endowments, the motive of win/win, and the skills of empathic communication on the toughest challenges we face in life. What results is almost miraculous. We create new alternatives, something that wasn't there before. Synergy is the essence of principle-centered leadership. It is the essence of principle-centered parenting. It catalyzes, unifies, and unleashes the greatest powers within people. All the habits we have covered prepare us to create the miracle of synergy. What is synergy? Simply defined, it means that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. It means that the relationship which the parts have to each other is a part in and of itself. It is not only a part, but the most catalytic, the most empowering, the most unifying, and the most exciting part. The creative process is also the most terrifying part, because you don't know exactly what's going to happen or where it is going to lead. You don't know what new dangers and challenges you'll find. It takes an enormous amount of internal security to begin with the spirit of adventure, the spirit of discovery, the spirit of creativity. Without doubt, you have to leave the comfort zone of base camp and confront an entirely new and unknown wilderness. You become a trailblazer, a pathfinder. You open new possibilities, new territories, new continents, so that others can follow. Synergy is everywhere in nature. If you plant two plants close together, the roots commingle and improve the quality of the soil so that both plants will grow better than if they were separated. If you put two pieces of wood together, they will hold much more than the total of the weight held by each separately. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. 1 plus 1 equals 3 or more. The challenge is to apply the principles of creative cooperation, which we learn from nature, in our social interactions. Family life provides many opportunities to observe synergy and to practice it. The very way that a man and a woman bring a child into the world is synergistic. The essence of synergy is to value differences, to respect them, to build on strengths, to compensate for weaknesses. We obviously value the physical differences between men and women, husbands and wives. But what about the social, mental, and emotional differences? Could these differences not also be sources of creating new, exciting forms of life, creating an environment that is truly fulfilling for each person, that nurtures the self-esteem and self-worth of each, that creates opportunities for each to mature into independence and then gradually into interdependence? Could synergy not create a new script for the next generation, one that is more geared to service and contribution, and is less protective, less adversarial, less selfish, one that is more open, more trusting, more giving, and is less defensive, protective, and political, one that is more loving, more caring, and is less possessive and judgmental? Synergistic communication. When you communicate synergistically, you are simply opening your mind and heart and expressions to new possibilities, new alternatives, new options. It may seem as if you are casting aside habit too, to begin with the end in mind, but, in fact, you're doing the opposite, you're fulfilling it. You're not sure when you engage in synergistic communication how things will work out or what the end will look like, but you do have an inward sense of excitement and security and adventure, believing that it will be significantly better than it was before. And that is the end that you have in mind. You begin with the belief that parties involved will gain more insight, and that the excitement of that mutual learning and insight will create a momentum toward more and more insights, learnings, and growth. Many people have not really experienced even a moderate degree of synergy in their family life or in other interactions. They've been trained and scripted into defensive and protective communications or into believing that life or other people can't be trusted. As a result, they are never really open to habit 6 and to these principles. This represents one of the great tragedies and wastes in life, because so much potential remains untapped, completely undeveloped and unused. Ineffective people live day after day with unused potential. They experience synergy only in small, peripheral ways in their lives. They may have memories of some unusual creative experiences, perhaps in athletics, where they were involved in a real team spirit for a period of time. Or perhaps they were in an emergency situation where people cooperated to an unusually high degree and submerged ego and pride in an effort to save someone's life or to produce a solution to a crisis. To many, such events may seem unusual, almost out of character with life, even miraculous. But this is not so. These things can be produced regularly, consistently, almost daily in people's lives. But it requires enormous personal security and openness and a spirit of adventure. Most all creative endeavors are somewhat unpredictable. They often seem ambiguous, hit or miss, trial and error. And unless people have a high tolerance for ambiguity and get their security from integrity to principles and inner values, they find it unnerving and unpleasant to be involved in highly creative enterprises. Their need for structure, certainty, and predictability is too high. Synergy in the classroom. As a teacher, I have come to believe that many truly great classes teeter on the very edge of chaos. Synergy tests whether teachers and students are really open to the principle of the whole being greater than the sum of its parts. There are times when neither the teacher nor the student knows for sure what's going to happen. In the beginning, there's a safe environment that enables people to be really open and to learn and to listen to each other's ideas. Then comes brainstorming, where the spirit of evaluation is subordinated to the spirit of creativity, imagining, and intellectual networking. Then an absolutely unusual phenomenon begins to take place. The entire class is transformed with the excitement of a new thrust, a new idea, a new direction that's hard to define, yet it's almost palpable to the people involved. Synergy is almost as if a group collectively agrees to subordinate old scripts and to write a new one. I'll never forget a university class I taught in leadership philosophy and style. We were about 3 weeks into a semester when, in the middle of a presentation, one person started to relate some very powerful personal experiences which were both emotional and insightful. A spirit of humility and reverence fell upon the class, reverence toward this individual and appreciation for his courage. This spirit became fertile soil for a synergistic and creative endeavor. Others began to pick up on it, sharing some of their experiences and insights and even some of their self-doubts. The spirit of trust and safety prompted many to become extremely open. Rather than present what they prepared, they fed on each other's insights and ideas and started to create a whole new scenario as to what that class could mean. I was deeply involved in the process. In fact, I was almost mesmerized by it because it seemed so magical and creative. And I found myself gradually loosening up my commitment to the structure of the class and sensing entirely new possibilities. It wasn't just a flight of fancy, there was a sense of maturity and stability and substance which transcended by far the old structure and plan. We abandoned the old syllabus, the purchased textbooks and all the presentation plans, and we set up new purposes and projects and assignments. We became so excited about what was happening that in about 3 more weeks, we all sensed an overwhelming desire to share what was happening with others. We decided to write a book containing our learnings and insights on the subject of our study, Principles of Leadership. Assignments were changed, new projects undertaken, new teams formed. People worked much harder than they ever would have in the original class structure, and for an entirely different set of reasons. Out of this experience emerged an extremely unique, cohesive, and synergistic culture that did not end with the semester. For years, alumni meetings were held among members of that class. Even today, many years later, when we see each other, we talk about it and often attempt to describe what happened and why. One of the interesting things to me was how little time had transpired before there was sufficient trust to create such synergy. I think it was largely because the people were relatively mature. They were in the final semester of their senior year, and I think they wanted more than just another good classroom experience. They were hungry for something new and exciting, something that they could create that was truly meaningful. It was an idea whose time had come for them. In addition, the chemistry was right. I felt that experiencing synergy was more powerful than talking about it, that producing something new was more meaningful than simply reading something old. I've also experienced, as I believe most people have, times that were almost synergistic, times that hung on the edge of chaos and for some reason descended for it. Sadly, people who are burned by such experiences often begin their next new experience with that failure.